This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
That's something I follow very closely. This is contested topic, needless to say. The techno-optimists say that with a lot more investment in new mining technology, and if we put aside any concern about the environment whatsoever, that we can indeed extract more oil from the earth. The problem with that argument is that most of the oil fields that we now rely on, the giant oil fields that have produced modern civilization, are running out very swiftly, and there's nothing anybody can do to stop that. We're going to lose 70%, 75% of current oil production in the next 25 years from existing fields. And the new fields that are being developed in the Arctic, offshore, in shale formations, are much more expensive and difficult and hazardous to produce. So it's unclear that this new technology, these new methods of extraction, will ever be able to replace the lost oil that we're going to have from existing fields.
Well, one thing that really, heck, a statistic that blows my mind is that with the first oil field back in Pennsylvania in 1859, they struck oil at 69 feet.
Yeah.
Of course, now they go, you know, miles under the ocean and horizontally and everything else. And then there's the shale, fracking of shale oil, which people seem to think that that's a huge reservoir just waiting to be tapped. But it isn't, is it?
No. People don't understand. They think it's like the oil of the past. You drill into the earth and it comes spurting out, and nothing could be further from the truth. The oil and shale is droplets, molecules of oil trapped in dense rock, and the only way you could get it out is to explode the rock, to smash it apart with water cannons, underground water cannons. That's what hydrofracking is. And this is a very costly way of going about things. It's questionable how effective it will be over the long term, but the main thing is it has tremendous environmental risks associated with it.
Let's talk a little bit about water also. You know, you have a constant supply of water. It never really goes away, but it's becoming scarce. The usable water is becoming scarce.
Yes, there are several problems with water. I don't believe that population growth is the root of all of our problems. I think consumption is. But in the case of water, if the water supply doesn't increase and you have a unsustainable growth in population, then the amount of water per capita declines. And that's what's happening in places like North Africa, the Middle East, and Central Asia. There's no increase in the supply of water from the rivers that exist there. In fact, they're going to lose water because of climate change. But with population growth, each time you double population, that means each person has half as much water as the previous generation. And this is going to create, I fear, a lot of strife in areas that are already prone to conflict.
Well, you mentioned the Carter Doctrine, which was based on access to oil, and that was used by both Presidents Bush to justify their wars against Iraq.
Yes, well, interesting you talk about Iraq, because we went there to fight over the global control over oil, as I believe it. But Iraq now is suffering from water scarcity, and this is true throughout the Middle East. They may have oil, but they don't have water. So with all of their oil wealth, it's unclear that they are going to be able to provide themselves with enough water to meet their basic needs, and this may be a greater cause of instability in the future than the fight over oil, although those fights will continue as well.
I don't know. It almost sounds like a vision of the future where you have a country that has no people because they can't grow their food, but you might have isolated oil wells or something like that. It just seems kind of surreal to me.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, this is themes that have been written about in science fiction and some of the movies we know, but this may well prove to be reality in the not-too-distant future. Again, I say if we don't change our behavior in time, there certainly are people who are suggesting ways of behaving differently, of consuming less, of using water and oil more efficiently, switching to renewables. And if we go down that path, these worst-case scenarios don't have to come about.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you have, okay, these are the two main causes of war. Where do you think they might break out? We've already seen wars in the Middle East. Now we have this thing going on in Syria. What's interesting to me is that Syria apparently has, off their coast, there are oil fields and gas fields.
Yes, indeed. And Syria is located right in the middle of many other key countries from the perspective of both water and oil. Syria is also a transit point or a potential transit point for oil coming from Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, the Middle East, to the Mediterranean and to the rest of the world. So geographically, it's in a very significant location. The amount of oil Syria has is not that great, but its location in the oil world is very significant, which is why so many countries are becoming involved in the outcome of the fighting there.
Mm-hmm. Well, they say that these gas fields might have an awful lot of gas, just, you know, because they border the gas fields that Israel has discovered.
Yeah, well, this is an area, you're absolutely right, Per, that this is an area where we could see conflict arising over natural resources, not over oil, but over natural gas, because Israel wants it, Lebanon wants it, Turkey wants it, Syria wants it, Cyprus wants it, and Cyprus is a divided country. Mm-hmm. And the two sides are fighting amongst themselves, one backed by Turkey, the Turkish enclave on Cyprus, the other, the independent country that's just been in economic meltdown. All these countries claim, and the Palestinians of the West Bank, I'm sorry, the Palestinians of the Gaza Strip, mm-hmm. also claim this offshore oil. And so, and the boundaries are not defined. So this could become a flashpoint for conflict in the future.
Yeah, could it be? Could you have a situation where, say Israel starts developing this first? I mean, and they tap into this gas field. Would they also be tapping into the gas that sort of belongs to Syria and Gaza and other countries?
This is exactly what is happening.
Mm.
In fact, they are starting to drill into these fields, and the fields do overlap in the territory of the Gaza Strip on one side and Lebanon on the other side. And the authorities in those places are claiming that Israel is doing exactly what you say, is stealing natural resources that should be shared.
Well, I think that was something that Iraq was claiming that Saudi Arabia was doing, too, at one time.
Well, certainly they charged, that was the charge that Saddam Hussein levied against Kuwait.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That the Kuwaitis were mm-hmm. drilling into their field, the Rumala oil field, as a cause of the invasion. Now, whether that is accurate or not, if that's really what he was about, who's to say? But it certainly was part of the discourse. There's another area of the world, though, that worries me terribly, where this is exactly the issue, Per, and that is the near fighting that's taking place in the East China Sea between China and Japan,
mm-hmm.
and in the South China Sea between China, the Philippines, and Vietnam. In that area, you have huge underground natural gas fields and oil fields that are contested, the boundaries are contested, and all of them, especially China and Japan, are becoming increasingly militaristic in their disputes. There have been pictures of Chinese and Japanese ships coming, you know, within spitting distance of each other, threatening each other. And this is the way wars begin.
Mm-hmm. Well, the U.S. has taken a role. Do you think the U.S. is helping solve this or just kind of stirring things up more?
Well, that's the key question, and I'm very critical of the United States for not seeking to try to avert these conflicts from or preventing them from escalating, particularly in the Pacific, where the Pacific Pivot Strategy announced by President Obama a year or so ago calls for a tougher U.S. military posture in the East China Sea and the South China Sea, and being more supportive of our allies there, Japan and the Philippines and so on. And I think this is creating a much more tense and threatening environment in those disputes than would be the case otherwise. And bear in mind, we're talking about a situation that would involve major powers armed with nuclear weapons, China and the United States, if it came to that.
Do you think they could resolve this on their own if they were allowed to or kind of encouraged? I think
that it's possible. You have a problem that the new political leadership in Japan is ultra-nationalistic and militaristic, Shinzo Abe, the new prime minister. You have a problem that the new Chinese leadership is untested, and they're trying to show we're not going to back down. So this is a very dangerous environment in the East China Sea and the South China Sea that doesn't get the attention it deserves.
Then you have all this business with North Korea, which I don't know if that's just sort of a sideshow or whether it's related to all this.
I think that has a history of its own, obviously, mm-hmm. but it makes it harder for these countries to cooperate with one another, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is Per Fagerheim, and the show is Fight the Empire. My guest is Michael Clare, who is the author of his most recent book, is The Race for What's Left. And he has a recent article in the Tom Dispatch on the coming global explosion. One question it's been on my mind, you know, we have a lot of, oil has been discovered in Africa, and that seems to be the new center of the world's attention. Right now the European economies are, at least in southern Europe, on the verge of collapse. Do you think that maybe Europe is looking to Africa to kind of save its own economies?
Well, I think that's an interesting perspective you have. I think Europe is desperate place right now, as you say. I think that Europe has always exploited Africa in every which way it possibly can. That has been the history of European-African relations as far back as we could see, certainly back to the Roman Empire. So, yes, I think the Europeans do have an inclination to exploit Africa some more. What their capacity is, I'm not sure. But what worries me about Africa is not so much the Europeans, it's the fact that China now is seeking to exploit China's resources as well as the United States. So Africa is becoming a field for geopolitical competition between all these powers, and of course the Africans themselves will be the ones who will suffer the most out of this competition.
Well, is there any way that they can kind of play off both sides? You know, that was one of the things that happened during the Cold War with the Soviet Union was that, you had a sort of competition to see who could, make the better deal with allies around the world.
Yeah, well, you're right about that, and that's certainly what you see happening in Central Asia and the Caspian Sea area, where countries like Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan are playing exactly that role. My feeling is, though, that this is really a dangerous game to play, mm-hmm. because what happens is you wind up becoming involved in the military competition between these powers. They want to use you as a pawn, and being a pawn on the at the control or at the behest of superpowers with their own agendas, a very dangerous place to be. But more than that, even more than that, the way in which this game is played off, a lot of it has to do with arms supplies and military training. And what happens in Africa is that this winds up with the dictators in power or the royal family or the cliques in power get to strengthen their military and police capacity and their ability to stamp out resistance and dissent. And you see that in Nigeria, you see that in Sudan, you see it in Mozambique and Zimbabwe, in Zimbabwe. The way in which this resource contest leads to the militarization and the repressive buildup of the rulers who are being courted by the foreign powers, and it results in greater repression and slaughter of people on the ground.
Well, see, I wonder if oil becomes more scarce, more expensive, wouldn't that change the way wars are fought?
That is a good question, and certainly there are people in the Pentagon who are looking into that very question. They worry that America's strategy, which relies very heavily on high-tech equipment to compensate for smaller numbers of troops, this is an oil-powered, an oil-driven strategy. The shock and awe of Donald Rumsfeld that was put to the test in Iraq, this is a petroleum-dependent strategy. And the Pentagon is worried that it's unsustainable for this very reason that you bring up. And so they are studying alternative fuels, biofuels in particular.
But if they don't pan out, I could see wars of the future being fought by basically infantry or, you know, with a lot of firepower, that, you know, shoulder-mounted firepower.
Well, this is an interesting question. My feeling is that the posture that the United States has adopted since World War II of being the global cop and having the expression they use is forward deployed, that having a mammoth military establishment deployed forward all over the world, sustained by oil, that this will not be possible in the future. Countries will be much more focused on regional defense and mm-hmm. local affairs, but the idea of a global superpower that can steam, can deploy and support forces on every continent all the time, I don't see how that's going to be possible in the future.
Kind of like the World Cup, but his patrol car is out of gas or something.
Yeah. So, I think, you know, realistically speaking, you know, if we were turning back 50 years from now and say, why is the U.S. pulling out of Afghanistan today? I think this is a big reason. It is unbelievably expensive and difficult, as we've discovered, to provide fuel and supplies and ammunition and food to our forces in Afghanistan mm-hmm. because the countries around them are unfriendly and the convoys are constantly attacked. And there's no logistical infrastructure there. You know, I understand there are political reasons and military reasons we're leaving, but one of the reasons we're leaving is that it's simply logistically impossible to do this in the future in a world where resources are scarce.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one question keeps leading to another. How do you think, what kind of future do you see for Israel? Surrounded by increasingly unstable countries, and if oil is expensive, you know, they rely so much on air power and, you know, armored power, where does that leave them?
Well, I think smart people in Israel are facing this question and are saying very clearly that the current posture of relying on militarism as the way to deal with it is not sustainable over the long term, that if Israel is to survive in this neighborhood, it will have to work out a modus operandi with its neighbors, some way of coexisting with them. And I don't think, you know, that's not just my perspective, but many smart people in Israel are saying that.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the climate change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, you say it's sort of starting in Africa and the Middle East and Asia, but it's going to spread, eventually it's going to spread all over the world. You could say it's already hit New York with the hurricane flooding the subways and everything else in New York.
Absolutely. I think that the kinds of phenomenon that I talk about in my article in Tom Dispatch are certainly going to not be confined to the African continent. Now, I spoke about there of the collision of resource scarcity and climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Not just the physical effects of climate change, but the social and political effects.
What would they be?
I do think we're going to see that more and more in our country and in Europe, if nothing else, because people are not going to be able to survive in places like Africa and Central America and Mexico, and they're going to want to move here. And that's going to lead to tremendous immigration clashes, conflicts along the border, racism arising from that fact.
Well, even within the United States, there was a woman who is an environmental lawyer who gave a talk to the Portland City Club a couple of years ago, and she said that one thing that kept her awake at night was what would Oregon do with climate refugees from the Southwest?
Oh, yes. That's exactly the sort of thing I had in mind. Absolutely. People from below the Rio Grande are going to want to move north, and people from into Texas and the South, American Southwest, and people from there are going to want to move further north as the Southwest becomes uninhabitable. You're absolutely right.
Well, I was reading, about Las Vegas. Of course, it's right next to the Hoover Dam and Lake Mead. And what I heard was that the level of the lake is dropping sort of pretty constantly. And I think right now, last I heard, the level was something 1,085 feet. And if it ever gets down to 1,050 feet, the turbines for the dam will shut off.
Mm.
And then
I don't know about that, but I can tell you that the major source of water for the entire Southwest and Southern California is the Colorado River.
Mm-hmm.
And all the projections are that over the long term, we can expect diminished water supply from the Colorado River. And considering that this is the fastest growing part of the United States, you could see how much trouble we're headed for.
Well, the Colorado River does not reach the ocean, I understand.
That is right.
Go ahead.
And this becomes an international matter because the last part of it is in Mexico, and the United States has a treaty with Mexico saying that they will receive a certain amount of water that's drinkable,
mm-hmm.
which is not the case.
Well, then the Rio Grande is in the same fix also.
Exactly.
I understand it barely reaches El Paso. And then below El Paso, there's a river in Mexico, I think the Rio Conchos. And the Mexicans, they say, are kind of holding back on that water. So the Rio Grande may not even reach the Gulf of Mexico. It hits a big sandbar at Brownsville or something like that.
This is going to be true, as you say, of the Rio Grande, of the Colorado River, of many of the other crucial rivers that we rely on with climate change.
Well, we're getting near the end of our show. Well, this is a pretty dire forecast here. What should we be doing about it right now?
I think that the obvious things are to find out how to conserve what we already have, to use the resources we have now as prudently, as conservatively as we possibly can. And we're making some progress in that direction. The new fuel efficiency standards adopted by Congress are going to kick in, making American cars more fuel efficient. So that's one side is efficiency and conservation, and the other side is to accelerate the development of renewables, and not just renewable energy, but renewable everything, because we're going to run out of all the basic building blocks of modern industrial civilization at the rate we're going.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to find replacements down the line for things like copper and steel and tin and platinum and all the rest. If we don't start now, we won't be ready in time when that need arises.
I think that's a good note to end our show on. We've been talking with Michael Clare, who is an author of The Race for What's Left and a recent article in the Tom Dispatch, which I really recommend. The Tom Dispatch is always worth out checking. And his article there is sort of the global, the coming global explosion. Thank you very much for being with us.
Always a pleasure to be in Portland.
Okay, thank you very much, Michael Clare.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Hey, good morning. 10 o'clock at KBOO Portland. Coming up in an hour from now at 11 on Between the Covers, host Jennifer Kemp interviews Ali Liebgott about her new novel, Cha-Ching, a story of what it means to be young and broke in America. And then at 11:30 on Black Book Talk, Clinton Galloway discusses his book, Anatomy of a Hustle, Cable Comes to South Central L.A., the story of two brothers setting out to better their community by establishing the first black-owned cable franchise in the country. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate today. It's time now for Flashpoints.
On Flashpoints, May Day in the middle of the Brown Revolution and the battle for immigrant and worker rights. Flashpoint senior producer Miguel Gavilan Molina will join us live from a major migrant rally and migrant rights worker rally in Oakland, California. We'll be joined by our contributor Francisco Herrera, who will report from farm worker country and the California boom town of Santa Rosa. We'll speak to a member of the Board of Supervisors of Alameda County, California, who just voted to end cooperation with Homeland Security's Draconian Secure Communities, or ESCOM program, although the sheriff vows he will not follow the board and the will of the people. And we will rebroadcast our interview with the internationally celebrated Mexican unionist leader in exile, Napoleon Gomez, who says that the responsible owners of the illegal Bangladesh garment factory that recently killed over 400 young workers should be prosecuted as mass industrial murderers. I'm Dennis Burns, seeing all this straight ahead on Flashpoint. Stay tuned. It's May Day on Flashpoints. Flashpoints, your daily investigative news magazine. My name is Dennis Bernstein, and joining us from Oakland, California, is Miguel Gavilan Molina. He's a senior producer here on Flashpoints. And Miguel, where exactly are you at the moment?
Well, I'm actually on in the Fruitvale District, and I'm on High Street, literally right down the block here of Mi Pueblo, where the marchers are just about gathering there to have a preliminary rally protest against the actions of Mi Pueblo.
All right. And who exactly is marching there? What is the theme of this rally? What's the focus?
Well, the focus is, again, you know, to push for immigration reform. That's been something that has been the burning issue, not just in the Latino, but the Asian and other immigrant communities, to get immigration reform done, you know, as a done deal. We've been, you know, people have been waiting for 10 years, Dennis. 10 years ago, the freedom, the freedom buses left the Bay Area and joined across the country to get immigration reform. And here we are 10 years later, literally on the anniversary of that movement, still fighting for immigrant rights and the overhaul of immigration, which is a broken system. But there's a lot of hope here and a lot of pressure, and people are saying, you know, what the immigration, the Gang of Eight did as far as a proposal on immigration is not really acceptable. Now they're talking about, Dennis, recently in the last couple of days, that some of the sections of the so-called proposal are going to be rewritten. And that's a major, major concern for people. But one thing that's clear here today is that people are not going to back down. And the message is, you know, we're not going to stop. It's only going to grow. This has to be dealt with. It has to be addressed.
Well, Miguel Gavilan Molina, one of the people addressing it and on the front lines is a good friend of yours, of ours, of Pacifica Radio, and certainly of the day labor movement. Gabriel Hernandez joins us now. Welcome back to Flashpoints. It's an honor to have you with us, Gabriel.
Hey, how you doing? How's everyone doing today?
We're doing good. We're glad to have you with us. I want you to say just a bit about the work you've been engaged in. Tell us what this movement is about and why May Day should be significant here. Tell us about this new movement, this workers' rights, this migrant-immigrant rights movement.
Years, what's happened is, you know, we've been out on the streets, you know, demanding reform in terms of the process to become, you know, a pathway to citizenship. For a number of years, it's been ignored. For a number of years, there's been other priorities like health care and other things. And now is the time for us to be rising up, like some years past, where we were demanding that, you know, again, we've been here, we want to be here, we're participating in the communities. Our day labor centers provide that opportunity to be able to organize workers to participate in as good residents in all the cities that they are. We've been in Hayward since 2007, and we've proposed to open up a center here in Oakland.